From National Public Radio, this is another in a series of programs from the National Press Club. In Washington, I'm Andra Armstrong. Today's guest speaker is documentary filmmaker Ken Burns, producer of the highly acclaimed PBS Civil War series, which aired in September and drew the highest ratings of any series in public television history. Latest figures indicate 38 million viewers saw at least part of the 11-hour program. While the Civil War series has brought 37-year-old Mr. Burns sudden nationwide fame, he's not a newcomer to critical success. He won Oscar nominations for his 1981 production about the Brooklyn Bridge and his 1985 documentary about the Statue of Liberty. His next big project for PBS will be a 9-segment program on baseball that's scheduled to air in 1993. Today, Mr. Burns will discuss the 5 years he spent making the Civil War series. We'll hear from Ken Burns in just a moment. But first, here's Gil Klein of the National Press Club.
Our guest today is Ken Burns, the filmmaker who last month brought his interpretation of the Civil War into the homes of millions of public broadcasting viewers. Now, television critics can be a hard lot to please, and I would say that Tom Shales of the Washington Post can be among the most acerbic. So what did Tom Shales have to say about Ken Burns' Civil War? He said it was not just good television, nor was it just great television. It was heroic television. Walter Goodman of the New York Times said Burns' Civil War, quote, almost redeems the promise of the medium, close quote. Heroic television that redeems the medium. Those are accurate compliments for a fellow who was able to hold the nation spellbound for 11 hours by taking thousands of old fuzzy photographs and putting them to music. I say we forget the speech and we all go out to the Potomac River and watch Ken Burns walk across it. Hallelujah. It's been quite a heady month for this gentleman. Not only was his show a smash success that made his name a household word across the nation, but the book that was written to accompany the show reached number one on the Washington Post nonfiction bestseller list this week. And that's quite an achievement alone, considering that it's hefty weight. No one bought it to read at the beach. But who is this 37-year-old whom historian Shelby Foote described as looking like a young grandson who got sent home from military school for refusing to get his regulation haircut? Well, he's the son of a University of Michigan anthropology teacher who attended Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. But when he graduated in 1975, he did not go to Hollywood, as most aspiring filmmakers would. Instead, he went to Walpole, New Hampshire, founding his own film company and living meagerly while doing the work he loves, developing historical documentaries. He won Oscars and Emmys before he started his epic Civil War project. It took him 5.5 years to create the Civil War, longer than the actual conflict. How he did it has been written about extensively. Those 16,000 photographs, the sound effects accurate to the bird calls soldiers heard before a battle, the quotes from diaries and letters, the voices to make Lincoln, Grant, and Lee sound familiar, and the historians to interpret the tale. Ken Burns says that the Civil War to him was never about dates and facts. It was about people and their passions, and that is certainly what he was able to portray on television. But what made the documentary so valuable was that this Michigan-raised and New England-educated filmmaker sought so exhaustively for the truth that only the most diehard radicals of both North and South have quibbled with his interpretation. In fact, he pointed out to me that he is wearing both blue and gray today. He has got a gray jacket and the blue sweater. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm Press Club welcome for filmmaker Ken Burns.
We have shared the incommunicable experience of war. We have felt, we still feel, the passion of life to its top. In our youths, our hearts were touched with fire. That was Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. He could have just as easily been speaking about the experience of this country in the last several weeks as he was his own heroic acts 130 years ago during the Civil War. Good afternoon. I am delighted to have this opportunity to return to the National Press Club, to try in our brief time here together to fathom a little about the present and a lot about our past as individuals and as a nation. As an individual, though, I feel compelled to acknowledge the help and assistance I have received over the last 5.5 years of making this film before I can begin to speak to the issues it has raised. WETA has been a constant partner throughout the whole project. Ward Chamberlain, Sharon Rockefeller, Tammy Robinson literally held us together while this project was being made. The Civil War, the series that is, was made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, an early, early supporter of this dream. Don Ledwig is here today. Thank you, Don. The National Endowment for the Humanities and its enlightened chairman, Lynn Cheney, he also here today. The Arthur Vining Davis Foundation, my old friend Max King Morris, executive director, and the MacArthur Foundation, the late and dear Bill Kirby, an ardent believer as well. The sole corporate sponsor was General Motors, Roger Smith and Robert Stempel, chairman, who trusted and nurtured with extraordinary support my belief that history, good history, could reach and touch millions. You know, many times during the course of the production, reporters would approach me and wanting to know about General Motors' angle, as they put it. First, whether GM had supported the Civil War series to counteract Michael Moore's film, Roger and Me. They did not. GM came on board long before any of us had ever heard of Mr. Moore. And then second, what were my thoughts on the aforementioned so-called documentary? Well, I declined to comment, saying it would be entirely inappropriate for me to respond given GM's support of my work. It could only, would only, obviously be misconstrued. But I think I added that if I had made the film, it would have been Roger and I. Humor, of course, played an important role in the Civil War, too, easing the pain and relieving the horror we were visiting on our own family members. During the long, cold, rainy winter of 1863, Confederate forces huddled in defensive positions around the Duck River near Tullahoma, Tennessee. Confederate officers liked to explain that Tullahoma came from the Greek word tulla, meaning mud, and homa, meaning more mud. Abraham Lincoln said if he ever met a man homelier than himself, he'd shoot the wretch and put him out of his misery. Stonewall Jackson never ate pepper. He thought it made his left leg ache. And he rode into battle with one arm raised to keep, he said, the blood balanced. And he never mailed a letter if he thought it would be in transit on a Sunday. The bombastic John Pope, a terrible, terrible Union general, so often signed his dispatches headquarters in the saddle that Lincoln finally said Pope had his headquarters where his hindquarters should be. Ulysses S. Grant said he knew only two tunes. One was Yankee Doodle, the other wasn't. And particularly appropriate today, Sherman said that he hated newspaper men so much that if he killed them all, there would be news from hell before breakfast. Sorry, Charlie. For many of us, we are brought to our history in just this fashion, with story, memory, anecdote, feeling. These emotional connections become a kind of glue, which makes the most complex of past events stick in our minds and in our hearts, permanently a part of who each of us is now. But for the most of the life of this republic, the way we have formally told our history was from the top down. This has been called the history of the state or of great men. And it basically focuses on presidents and wars and generals. It relies, like certain current economic policies, on an erroneous belief that history trickles down and touches experiences common to us all. It rarely does. It does exhibit, or has exhibited, an understandable arrogance, and we have to rely on family memory and community recollection for the good stuff, or at least the stuff that made all that political history tolerable, meaningful. But as we've grown older as a country, as we've moved around more, lost touch with place more, these personal histories have dried up for most people, and we began to forget. History became a kind of castor oil of dry dates and facts, but of events of little meaning. Something we knew was good for us, but hardly good tasting. History became just another subject, not the great pageant of everything, everything that has come before this moment. This moment, that is history. About 20 or 30 years ago, we woke up, partially, to this problem and began to insist on a relevance in our teaching of history and on a new social history that would focus on real people doing real and recognizable things. This would be history from the bottom up, not top down, and people would respond. They did not. Relevance became an excuse for not even teaching history, and the new social history became so bogged down in statistical demographics and micro-perceptions that history began to sound like the reading of a telephone book. A new arrogance replaced the old, equally understandable, I'm sorry to say, but equally devastating to the national memory. Someone expressed this new tyranny quite well when they said that a history of Illinois could be written without even mentioning Abraham Lincoln. Something had to change. I'm pleased to report that in some ways it has. We have, as an academy, begun to speak of a synthesis of the old and new histories, a way to combine the best of the top-down version, still inspiring even in its great men addiction, with the bottom-up version, so inspiring too at times, with the million heroic acts of women, minorities, labor, ordinary people. And we have begun to use new media and new forms of expression to tell our histories, breaking the stranglehold the Academy has had on historical exchange for the last 100 years. Remember, until we adopted the Germanic academic model at the end of the 19th century, our greatest historians, like Parkman and Adams, were essential amateurs, popular writers, concerned with speaking to large audiences, not just a handful of colleagues, unconcerned with how one wrote. Listen to what Francis Parkman had to say about the historian's responsibility. "Faithfulness to the truth of history," he wrote, "involves far more than a research, however patient and scrupulous, into special facts. Such facts may be detailed with the most minute exactness, and yet the narrative, taken as a whole, may be unmeaning or untrue." Unmeaning or untrue. The narrator must seek to imbue himself with the life and spirit of the time. He must study events in all their bearings, near and remote, in the character, habits, and manners of those who took part in them. He must himself be, as it were, a sharer or a spectator of the action he describes. The telling of history is a tension between art and science. The science of history would enumerate the myriad details equally, without discrimination, the telephone book at its worst. The art of history has produced Gone with the Wind, and worse, The Birth of a Nation, and recent miniseries dramas which try to convince us that it was not brother against brother, but perhaps bosom against bosom. Good history has always struck a balance between these two polarities, never allowing formal considerations to overwhelm and capsize the truth of events, nor allowing a dry recitation of fact to render its meaning unintelligible, or worse, boring. In an age of changing media, these dangers and pitfalls become even more critical, require even more of our vigilance and attention if we are to survive. For it is a question of survival, I believe. Without any past, certainly the current national elective, we will deprive ourselves of the defining impressions of our being. Not far from Abraham Lincoln's White House last winter, Václav Havel, the new poet president of Czechoslovakia, spoke about the salvation of the human world. That salvation, he said, lies nowhere else than in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human weakness, and in human responsibility. Freely quoting the 16th president, Havel acknowledged that Lincoln, too, knew about the human heart and the human world. More than 150 years ago, in 1838, Abraham Lincoln challenged us to consider the real threat to the country, to consider forever the real cost of our inattention. "Whence shall we expect the approach of danger?" he wrote. "Shall some transatlantic giant step the earth and crush us at a blow?" Never. All the armies of Europe and Asia could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track in the Blue Ridge in the trial of 1,000 years. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we will live forever or die by suicide. Lincoln, of course, presided over the closest this country has ever come to national suicide. This was the Civil War, our great, tragic, epic story, the American Iliad, as relevant today as at any time in our history. It was a poignant family drama that reveals more of the American character, is more defining of us as a nation than any other event before or after. If I said I had been working for these many years on a film series about the imperial presidency, about a developing feminist movement, about an ever-present, indeed defining civil rights question, about greedy Wall Street speculators who'd stole millions trading on inside information, about unscrupulous military contractors who sold inferior goods at exorbitant prices to the government, about a prying, insensitive, at sometimes meddlesome press, about new weapons capable of mass destruction on a scale previously unheard of, it would be clear that I was speaking about the present. But of course, I am speaking of only a few of the issues of the American Civil War, a war that continues to speak to the central questions of our present time. It is, therefore, no accident that the best-selling nonfiction book last year was James McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom, that the Hollywood movie Glory did so well, that it was made at all, that the Library of America's best-selling volumes are the writings of Lincoln, that from editorial page to opinion page, writers are quoting and citing Lincoln, that battlefield reenactments groups continue to grow, that dozens of books seeking to explain the war's special significance are published each year, that Hollywood plans still more films, that we have released our 5-year labor of love. Each generation, Lewis Mumford once said, rediscovers and reexamines that part of the past which brings the present new meaning and new possibilities. The Civil War, like at no other time in our history, now brings that special correspondence to our present, shocking us with its power to inform and invigorate. I was drawn to the Civil War because it seemed to be the central influence on all the other subjects I had made films about. I assembled a first-rate team, including my brother Rick, the writer Jeffrey C. Ward, editor Paul Barnes, narrator David McCullough, the incomparable Shelby Foote, a genuine national treasure, and more than 36 remarkable voices, men and women in arts and letters, who read from diaries, journals, love letters, military dispatches, newspapers, that give our presentation of the war, I hope, an experiential feeling. Of course, we have here today in Jody and Charlie two wonderful examples of those voices, weighted heavily to the south, though I might. We concerned ourselves with ordinary soldiers as well as the great politicians and generals, followed the fortunes of two towns, north and south, as well as the great battles of the war. We looked at the diplomatic struggle, the role of women, and most important, reported the true and heroic story of American blacks, not as mere passive bystanders to the struggle, but active, dedicating, self-sacrificing soldiers in an intensely personal drama of self-liberation. At 4:30 a.m. on the 12th of April, 1861, General Pierre-Gustave Toutant Beauregard directed his Confederate gunners to open fire on Fort Sumter, at that hour only a dark shape out in Charleston Harbor. 34 hours later, a white flag over the fort ended the bombardment. The only casualty was a Confederate horse. It was a bloodless opening to the bloodiest war in American history. No one could have predicted the magnitude of the explosion that rocked America following that opening shot. Until then, America had been, as Bruce Catton wrote, small enough to carry in the mind and in the heart, and a young man's fatherland was what he could see from his bedroom window. Yet most of what America was before the Civil War went into sparking that explosion. and most of what it became resulted from it. Entirely unimaginable before it began, the war was the most defining and shaping event in American history, so much so that it is now impossible to imagine what we would have been like without it. Shortly after Appomattox, Walt Whitman, a Brooklyn journalist and sometime poet who worked in the appalling Union hospitals, warned posterity of what he had seen. "Future years," he wrote, "will never know the seething hell and the black infernal background, the countless minor scenes and interiors of the secession war, and it is best they should not. The real war," he said, "will never get in the books." The writers and historians of future years have not been scared off by Whitman. In the century and a quarter since the war's conclusion, more than 50,000 books have been published on the Civil War. We believe more than any other subject except Jesus Christ. Countless personal diaries and regimental histories, biographies and military narratives, pictorial essays, social analyses, works that have treated causes and effects, demographics, crop statistics, even the weather. There have been books of maps, books of letters, books of orders, books of books, slim philosophical essays, and massive three-volume narratives, novels, poems, and music. Each year, dozens of new titles appear, again offering to revisit the war, to reinterpret or rearrange those strange days and hard events, looking still for the coherent, the conclusive explanation. And yet Whitman's words retain their force. The real war stays there, outside all the books, beckoning to us. Why did Americans kill each other, and how did it happen? Who were these people who fought and killed, marched and sang, wrote home, skedaddled, deserted, died, nursed and lamented, persevered, and were defeated? What was it like to be in that war? What did it do to America and Americans? What happened to the movement that freed blacks from slavery? Why have succeeding generations obscured the war with bloodless, gallant myth, blurring the causes of it and its great ennobling outcome, the freeing of 4 million black people and their descendants from bondage? What did it mean that the Union won? What does it mean to be a Union? Why are we still so drawn to this tale of suffering, catastrophe, heroism, and death? In the past 15 years, I have learned many things, but that history is our greatest teacher is perhaps the most important lesson. However, this enthusiasm is by no means shared by all. History and its valuable counsel continues to recede in importance and emphasis in schools across the land. The statistics are now very frightening. A majority of high school seniors do not know who Winston Churchill or Joseph Stalin were. They did not know of the Declaration of Independence, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the Bill of Rights, which came first, or why. Many thought we fought with the Germans against the Russians in the Second World War, and a majority could not tell the correct half century in which the Civil War took place. Who and what is to blame? I believe television, mostly. Television is rapidly eroding the strength of our republic from within, just as Lincoln predicted, substituting a distracting cultural monarchy for the diversity and variety and democracy promised in its conception and unveiling. Instead of dozens of options on the tube, we now see nearly the same thing everywhere, always presented the same way on dozens of clone-like channels. Television has equipped us as citizens to live only in an all-consuming and thereby forgettable and disposable present, blissfully unaware of the historical tides and movements that speak not only to this moment, but to our vast future as well. This environment ensures that we have no history, and by so doing, ensures that we have no future. Even supposedly enlightened shows do more harm than good, wind up serving the same Morphean end by conferring a kind of cultural peerage on the familiar talking heads that appear and reappear with striking sameness each night. Issues and ideas are merely pushed around the plate, never digested by the same people, always the same people, engaged more with a subtle one-upmanship among themselves and their TV alter egos than with the advancement of our understanding. In the worst of our television, we are addicted to personality, to the breathless embrace of celebrity, ensuring as we go a tyranny of the televised over the great mass of the untelevised. There can be no communication in this world except among equals. And how do we convince this monster of ours to confer on us the intelligence we so obviously have? Except for rare moments of great national trauma and in the form transcending moments of pure sport, like baseball, television confirms nothing in return but a potentially lethal light in our living rooms and in our minds. Even the best of those in television, and that includes us in public television, get caught up in near constant self-congratulation about their role in the medium, in near constant self-righteous invocation of shadowy, chilling effects and influences that would limit their constitutionally initiated rights, but always forgetting to stress to themselves and their audience how much the medium must improve, how little of its brain it actually uses, how by striving for a superficial ideal of balance, it has ensured mostly mediocrity. By its almost comic unearthing of simplistic villains, it has forgotten to select for heroes. There are a few... There are a few commandos demanding, insistent, a resistance force unwilling to yield to those who appeal only to the basest instincts of a medium whose most persistent excuse is the concept of LCD, lowest common denominator. It has been a powerful thing, remember. Let us not underestimate a form which can remove presidents, affect diplomacy, eras in history, even end wars. Television can remind us, too, if we let it. We know the horrible statistics about television, how it divides us, encourages us to see ourselves as economic units rather than spiritual beings, as Vartan Gregorian says. But we mustn't throw the medium out, turn away, or surrender its great power to those disingenuous people for whom it is merely the tool of some temporal or financial end. It is not enough to blame it all on television. Lincoln, in 1862, forced to place George McClellan, a slow, timid, but experienced general, back in charge of his humiliated army, said, "We must use the tools we have." Let us use these tools now, as we gradually become a country and a society without letter writing and diary keeping, and more dependent on visual signs and language. Television will become more and more an important part of the making of history. More and more we will be connected to the past by the images we have made, and they will become the glue that makes memories. We must also change what we think is history. The Civil War, the series, is like a poem, selective, impressionistic to be sure, but a legitimate form of historic expression. When I began this project, I asked one of our senior advisors, the distinguished historian C. Van Woodward, what book I should read to get started. He said, "John Brown's Body" by Stephen Vincent Benet. To Woodward, a Homeric epic poem was the place for us to start. So it is with television. We must begin to trust the language of our new forms. Better yet, we must study them, not in an effort to deconstruct them, to find artificially its verbs and nouns, syntax and grammar. That's an essentially formalistic digression. We must learn its language as an entirely new form. How the evidence of the past, be it a diary excerpt, an old photograph, a reminiscent, how they speak to us, what impressions they make. We must demand more of this form and more of ourselves. Eventually, television will, I suggest, become our new Homeric form, told around an electronic campfire, the way we can and must speak to succeeding generations. It seems too easy to dismiss its cruder aspects, to turn away from its clearly manipulative elements, or to cave into its seductive power. We must learn how to use it, make it speak our truths, tell our stories, our histories, in an honorable fashion. But I must confess that on September 23rd, 1990, we had no idea what to expect. That morning, I checked out of a hotel in Midtown Manhattan after more than 2 months on the road, trying to drum up support for what everyone agreed was an extremely risky experiment, running the Civil War for 5 consecutive nights during the height of the new commercial fall season. As I made the long trip home, sure the coming week would be a calm reprise, I assured my wife, the comments of several columnists who were sure that it would be, quote, eaten alive by the networks, kept echoing in my mind. We were all, therefore, completely unprepared for what was going to happen to our lives. Within minutes of the first night's broadcast, the phone began ringing off the hook with calls from across the country, eager to find out about Sullivan Ballou, anxious to learn the name of Jay Unger's superb theme music, A Shokan Farewell, written 8 years ago, desperate to share their family's experience in the war, or just kind enough to say thanks. The calls would not stop all week, and they continue still. Now we are recognized throughout the country, in stores, in airports, on city streets, even on the subway. Shelby Foote, rightfully so, has become a revered household name, indeed a sex symbol, I am told. He's married. We have become New Yorker cartoons and national public radio spoofs. The Tonight Show has called, and we have answered. Book signings sell out of our overpriced companion book in minutes. 30-something is putting the series into a new episode, we've just learned yesterday, and I think they have to change it to 130-something. You know? Reporters still call day and night, persistently finding new angles to keep the story alive, trying to figure out why, a century and a quarter later, the Civil War continues to speak to us in a clear voice. The series had touched a chord which is still vibrating and will continue to vibrate as long as the Republic lives. If you see the history of a country in the same sympathetic and personal way you see the life of a human being, then it is clear that the Civil War was the great traumatic event in the childhood of this nation. Disguise it as we may, ignore it as we usually do, distort it as we have so often done, we cannot ultimately not be continually influenced by this terrible, terrible memory of the 4 years during which we came close to ending our national life. My own mother died when I was 11, permanently changing me and permanently influencing all that I would become. The Civil War defines us in just that way, at both an intensely intimate level and in a broad national sense. Finally, of course, Lincoln, as always, said it best. Early in 1861, at his first inauguration, when he still hoped to keep his country together, he implored Southerners not to go to war. "We must not be enemies," he said. "We must be friends." But then he went on. "The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." The mystic cords of memory, the better angels of our nature. Thank you.
Today's guest speaker at the National Press Club is documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. Now we'll go to questions from the floor.
Get too many standing ovations at the National Press Club, especially from someone who just stood up and said half of our medium is not particularly good. Gives you an idea of what journalists think. A lot of questions here, and start off with something particular on the show. You said a couple of times during your remarks that the Civil War was the birthplace of feminism. Could you explain that further?
Yes, I think it's a very important point. For millennia before the Civil War, men had tried to convince women that they were not able to run businesses and farms and to do the work that they enjoyed. And the Civil War forced women into that position, and they found out that they could. The practical birthplace of feminism is the Civil War. Their philosophical underpinnings go back easily many centuries. But I think here, for the first time in mass numbers, women are discovering that they can handle the job very well. Thank you. and moved into hospitals as nurses. More than 400 disguised themselves as men and fought heroically in the Civil War until quite often they were discovered. School teachers were all men before the Civil War, and we thought that the important task of teaching our children was best left to men. After the Civil War, out of necessity and the lessons, the few lessons we had learned, we changed that.
Did you yourself find yourself developing a personal bond with any of the historical players of the Civil War, and were there any that you disliked intensely?
George McClellan still just bothers me a lot. I still can't understand George McClellan. Shelby doesn't like Philip Sheridan. He said I don't like small men who bristle a lot, which I thought that was good. But other than that, I really have no villains, and we had no villains in this piece except, of course, the horrible institution of slavery, and maybe George McClellan. One cannot help, of course, being drawn always to Abraham Lincoln, to Robert E. Lee, to some of the other important people there, and they have become like friends. If I tried to follow Parkman's advice to become a sharer, and I've ended up probably with a lot more sharing than I should have done. These men are all, and some women are very close to me.
Here's a question that probes your thoughts here. Are you a pacifist, and was the Civil War a just war, and would you have fought in it?
I began the project thinking that it would be a clever kind of anti-war piece, and it is that. It's a Trojan horse. It is our story, and of course the suffering that we inflicted on one another reminds us in a much clearer voice about the suffering that all wars inflict on human beings. I don't think I would call myself a pacifist, though that end was certainly in mind. I found, though, that the project became much more complex. There are just wars, and I would hope that I would have had the good sense to fight in it. For principles that I believed. That's a good question.
Of course, a lot of what you did had to get cut to get it down to 11 hours. What important threads of history did you have to cut, if any, in the interest of brevity?
Oh, we had to cut many important threads. It's a wonder the garment still is up. This is an impressionistic medium, as I said. I would have loved to tell more of the Trans-Mississippi War. What happened beyond the Mississippi was very important. There are very few images and necessarily had to go by the wayside. I would have loved to spend more time in the intrigues in Washington and in the Confederate cabinets. Particularly the Confederate cabinet was filled with a number of extraordinary people, Judah Benjamin and others, that we had actually in longer versions and had to leave out. If you've seen the movie Amadeus, there's a wonderful scene in which Franz Joseph, the emperor, is asked to remark on a piece of music that Mozart or someone has written, and he says, "Too many notes." Making film is often like that. It may be a beautiful note, but in the shape of the piece, be it an episode or a scene or the entire series, sometimes you take them out, not because they aren't good and beautiful, but because of too many notes.
Now, Washington, of course, was the home of a lot of secessionists during the war, and some of them are still here. They in our audience today. They want to know, why was the issue of slavery portrayed as the main issue of the war? Why was it not states' rights? And I'll go on. You can start with that.
The causes of the war are many, and people will be debating the causes of the war forever. This is really not the appropriate forum because we don't have another 11 hours to get into it. There are many important social, political, and economic reasons that feed into what we call states' rights. Central to all of them, though, is the terrible existence of the institution of slavery in a land which had just proclaimed itself a generation before that all men were created equal. It changed the social nature of the area that supported slavery. It changed the political nature as the country grew, and other states not wishing to perpetuate slavery began to threaten the parliamentary majority, or at least equality, that the southern slaveholding states had, that essentially sponsored the move towards secession and eventually the Civil War, and economic reasons, unfair burdens that the North placed on the South. It does come down to an economic one. The South essentially feared it would lose its property. Unfortunately, in this case, its property included, in 1860, 4 million other human beings. So while there are many contributing causes, all of which we dealt with in the film, the most important one is clearly slavery. John J. Chapman, writing in the early part of the 19th century, said, "There was never a moment in our history when slavery was not a sleeping serpent. It lay coiled under the table during the deliberations of the Constitutional Convention. Thereafter, slavery may have been on everyone's minds, but not on his tongue." I also have a nice story about, for all you unreconstructed Southerners out there, or unreconstructed wherever you might be, an anecdote a friend said the other day, that Robert E. Lee was invited after the war to the home of a widow who displayed with a great deal of anger a tree that had been damaged during the course of the war, and she said to him, "General Lee, General Lee, what are we to do?" And he said, "Madam, tear it down. The war is over."
Another question along that line. It was, "With Congress out of session, Lincoln called for an invasion of the 7 seceding states, thereby forcing 4 additional states out of the Union. Hopes for a quick victory notwithstanding, how does a decision that caused 623,000 American deaths qualify Lincoln for greatness? Was the preservation of the Union worth the price of a Holocaust?"
I think that's an excellent question. I believe it did, very simply. I think that we have a special mission as a country. We're still involved in that mission, and it required that the Union not be divided. Fortunately, many other issues besides the question of the survival of the Union ennobled the cause and made, I think, the sacrifice for all concerned not in vain. But that's an excellent question. Lincoln, as the steward of this, deserves greatness, as much because of the complicating nature of that question as in the simplicity that we sometimes attribute to heroes, or at least what we think our heroes are. Our heroes are complicated men and women who involve themselves in difficult questions and make a difference in our lives in a significant way, and Abraham Lincoln certainly has done that. He is here today in more ways than we know.
A number of questioners want to know more about particular things that were not in the show that got cut out. One asked, "Can you tell us why General Lew Wallace, author of Ben-Hur, got so little space in your history of the war?"
That's great. too many notes. We had a wonderful scene after the Battle of Shiloh in which we digressed, and unfortunately in film, which demands that you go on and on and on and not digress, we told you about some of the people who were at the Battle of Shiloh, including Lew Wallace, who would go on to write Ben-Hur and 2 presidents, Garfield and Hayes, I think, and also a man named, a little private who got captured. He was in the 4th Arkansas, and he got captured that second day of Shiloh and held prisoner and eventually was released or exchanged or something, named Henry Stanley, who was able to finally get to Africa and discover Dr. Livingston, which I thought was great.
This just in from Wheeling. The report of the formation of the state of West Virginia on January 20th, 1863, was left out on the cutting room floor. Can you tell us what you might have said about that?
Well, I just came from West Virginia a couple of weeks ago, where I patiently tried to explain why we had left West Virginia out, which is really unconscionable, and maybe we should have done our 18-hour film and had all of these things in it. We made a decision very early on not to focus on individual states and their great efforts and movements. In fact, I had planned and had filmed and had included many scenes of my own little town where I live right now in Walpole, New Hampshire, and its life throughout the Civil War, which went along with West Virginia, the home of the birthplace of my mother and where my great-great-grandfather, Abraham Burns, who fought with McClellan's horse artillery from Virginia was captured during the Civil War.
Your fleshing out of the character of General Sherman was a great highlight of the story. Was he, in your view, a good man?
Jody said, watch it now. This is now a minefield, of course. I found Sherman an extraordinary character. I think, quite rightly, the South has defined our memory, our literature, and our poetry of the war. The sense of loss and defeat has produced great creative efforts, including Eudora Welty and Robert Penn Warren and William Faulkner and Shelby Foote. And it's been very important to who we are as Americans to see the war through their eyes. In many cases, though, or in some cases, we've also not seen parts of the war because of the selectivity of those who have been, for the most part, the guardians of memory. The North got on with the business of making the country. The South, of course, for many, many reasons, could not. And a character who has been obscured by the one-dimensionality of that memory, William Tecumseh Sherman, deserves second and third looks, and we were pleased, at least in our superficial and limited form, to get to know him, how complicated first an individual he was, how brilliant his stroke was to attack the morale and heartland of the Confederacy without in any way excusing the terrible suffering that he visited on his own countrymen. I will avoid deciding good and not good men. That's left for other people besides myself or other powers. Sherman is an extraordinarily interesting man, and as Shelby would say, lights up page after page of history.
Did you do all the research yourself, and do you want to pay any tribute to any researchers?
We did the research ourselves. We had a few people who did. We felt it was very important that we decide what we were going to leave out and include as we went to the various archives. But much has been said recently about Ken Burns' film. And I must tell you that I am delighted to be here as the sort of corporal representation of that Ken Burns film. But a Ken Burns is also Rick Burns, my brother, who served as co-producer. Jeffrey C. Ward, the principal writer. David McCullough, extraordinary narrator. Shelby, the myriad voices. If your enjoyment of the series, if your recognition of the series bestows on me some compliments, I accept it only on their behalf because they make it all. They did the research all the way along the line. And indeed, beyond that, the funders that I mentioned in the beginning, particularly the National Endowment for the Humanities, who is the largest of our funders, and encouraged the kind of special and patient research that Francis Parkman, I think, would have applauded. These people are all the makers of this film. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to thank those who deserve it.
This questioner quotes you as saying, good history can touch millions. He goes on to say, bad history can touch millions as well. Give us an example of bad documentaries and describe to us the essential difference. That'll get you in more trouble.
I'm not going to touch that one. We know what bad history does. Some of it is unintentional, which is why it would be completely inappropriate to respond to that. Some of it is asleep. Nobody consciously goes out and makes a bad documentary or bad history. History is difficult to do. It requires time, it requires a patience, it requires a willingness, I believe, in allowing emotion to come in, to not be the dry dates and facts, but to be something more complicated than that, perhaps unknowable or undescribable, but which in the totality of its collection, as we've tried to do in the Civil War, speaks more to the heart than to the head. And that becomes an important way to communicate history. That's what we try to do, and we don't always succeed either.
This questioner wants to know is that the raw materials of history, such as family diaries and letters, what should people do who have these things to make them available to future historians?
Oh, that's a very good question. We've got to do a lot of things as a country besides support the institutions that support history, obviously, vigorously, to save our own, to keep our stories, to preserve them, to give them to local historical societies or to libraries if they're in danger. I've gotten dozens of letters from people desperate to know what to do with their family's record, and I can recommend wholeheartedly that we have in all of these libraries and historical societies around the country really our birthright and indeed our future. I think it was Gregorian who said that the libraries are the DNA of our society. Let's keep adding good genes to that strand. That's a good question.
A couple of would-be filmmakers out there want to know, how did you go about, from the time you conceived the idea to the time you got the money, how did you go about putting the funding together? What was the process, and what was your secret to get it?
I don't know about any secrets. There are other people at this table who might describe the secrets better than I could. I received a small grant from WETA and PBS to survive while we wrote proposals first to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which awarded a pre-production grant, which allowed us to do some preliminary filming and to prepare a much larger application to the National Endowment for the Humanities, which awarded us a combination of an outright and challenge grant, which we took to General Motors, who very enthusiastically agreed not only to fund production, but subsequently educational materials and a promotional ingredient to this thing so that people could be made aware that the project existed. We also approached and received grants from the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. And finally, as we expanded the project to 11 hours from the originally conceived five, which was too few notes, we went back to the National Endowment for the Humanities for a supplemental grant and to the MacArthur Foundation, which provided the final money for the project. It is not easy. It is not a sort of a cakewalk, and it required knowing a little bit about what we were doing, which fortunately we learned as we went and were aided by a distinguished panel of scholars from C. Van Woodward and Robert Penn Warren before he died, and Shelby, and many other people who made our way easy.
Tell us, a lot of people want to know what you're going to do next, and so they want to know, I understand you're going to do a history of baseball. And could you tell us, who are your researchers, and will it be like the Civil War?
Well, it will be different from the Civil War insofar as our young men will be playing in the field and not lying dead in it. That's the good news. We will attempt to put our arms around the history of baseball with, as we chose in the Civil War, the military aspect to be the central narrative, the narrative story of Major League Baseball to be the central core, but by no means the only core. It is divided into nine innings or chapters, which will detail particular eras in the game. We see baseball as the same thing as the Civil War, a way in, a way to understand who we are as a people, a Rosetta Stone where you can see writ quite clearly and plainly the soul of the country. The story of baseball is not just the story of games won and lost or interesting characters, just as the Civil War is not just about battles won and lost and interesting characters. It is also about women, about race and blacks, about immigration and assimilation, about the history of this country in the last 150 years, about greed, about labor, about linguistics, statistics. It is all those things and a continuing search for us about who we are.
Before asking the last question, I'd like to present you, I hope if I can find it here, here it is, a certificate of appreciation for appearing here.
Thank you very
and
much.
And I think in here, yeah, there it is, got pushed to the back, a National Press Club mug.
Great.
And the last question is, so what really is wrong with Gone with the Wind anyway?
There's nothing wrong with Gone with the Wind, but it leaves out so much. And we hope you have a chance to see the Civil War series again and again to find out what was left out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful.
You've been listening to another in a series of programs from the National Press Club. Today's guest speaker was documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. The technical director for today's broadcast was Suzanne Mesnick. John Ogolnik is our producer. Special thanks to Britt Lettman of the National Press Club. In Washington, I'm Andra Armstrong.